This is Emmett Early, 22 January 1986, Life Work of C.G. Jung, Tape 1 of 1.
I wanted to tell you a little bit about yourself. One third of you have not read any Jung. Four of you have read half of a book. That's how you tell if somebody really reads the surveys, isn't it? I like you half a bookers. I was that way for a long time about Jung myself. I started on the wrong book. So two-thirds of you know some Jung. There are actually 9 people here who have read over 40 books and admitted to it. And there are 7 people here who've read over 20 books and admitted to it. And I don't think that includes the presenters. So it's exactly as we expected. It's just a real broad spectrum. There are a number of you who identified yourselves as helping professionals of various sorts. We have physicians, and we have therapists, and we have teachers, and we have dancers, and we have people who are into mime, and people who are into poetry, and people into lots of things about life. And that was real helpful, and we appreciate your having filled them out. Some of the presenters actually read each and every one of the surveys. And I've read them all, and all the presenters have been given a synopsis of what is in there. What that says, of course, is that this is an impossible task, which is really encouraging, because it means that for some of you this is old stuff, and for some of you this is new stuff. And some of you want to talk about the difference between dialectic and dialogue, and some of you want to talk about the difference between what does ego mean, and and everything in between. So what's going to happen is that the presenters are going to not assume a tremendous amount of knowledge and background. For some of you, that will seem a little elementary, and for some of you, it still will be stretching. If it's stretching, I encourage you to do that. And if it's elementary, I encourage you to go with that flow, because that was the original intent in doing this. There are many of us who've read Jung or who've read other people's versions of Jung, which is even more dangerous in some ways. We emerged having an opinion or a notion about what he meant or what was meant by something. And this gives you an opportunity to hear it from someone who's been studying it for a long time in a thoughtful, careful kind of way. Okay? And to just sort of go, as I say, with the flow, to go with that process. You can't meet 392 people's every wish. We'd like to if we could. But the intent of the series was to offer in a systematic kind of a way a basic presentation of Jung's work. There will be, we are hatching many ideas, all the things that have been suggested in the last week. Based on a lot of your interest in the things that you said in the surveys, we're really cooking up some fun things. So, I've had some questions about the reading list and the course outline, and those things are not here this evening, but they will be next week. And what I would say in brief is that there are a whole lot more books out there than there were last week. And there's another shipment coming in for next week and sort of pick your way through. And they do have a copy of the reading list there. In terms of the change of schedule, Arwin Vasavada is speaking on the 19th of February. Most of you who were here have that. In that you got a change of schedule. So that on the 5th, you will be hearing about Anima Animus, with David Adams and Virginia Hoyt instead. And Vasavada is the one time when we will be in Kane Hall. So that is the one time when we will sell extra seats. Each evening, we will have a few extra seats available, as some of you have other things that you have to do. But it's nothing that people can count on. You have to save enough seats for the people who've already paid their money. But on the 19th of February, we'll be in Kane Hall. The way several of you asked me tonight, the way that you get extra tickets for that is you call 543-2300. I have memorized that number by now. And you simply say that you want to buy tickets. Okay? I suspect you can also bring people at the door. But for your own comfort, it's a good idea to get the tickets ahead of time. John Sanford, a number of you have asked me about that, and that I suspect you will be sold out in the sense that you will be here wanting to hear Sanford the last evening of the series. The Jung Society is sponsoring John Sanford. When he speaks to you on the 5th, he will be talking on the topic of the self. which is Jung's highest notion, and it seemed like a fitting person to talk about the self. Then on the 6th, he'll be speaking for the Jung Society in Kane Hall on evil. That's the title of his latest book, on evil. So that'll be a lot of fun, and that'll be open to the public. I'm sorry. I am not. Well, evil has its pleasant side, you know. Some get heckled by crowds and some get heckled by the presenters. I mean, again, a clarification about discussion groups. There will be a discussion group this evening, which is a situation where you don't have to sign up in advance. It will be, Virginia, where? Some room in this building. Okay. It's going to be in this building. And I suspect it's going to be in the seminar room that's the first hallway to your left, just past the coffee and the cookies. And they'll try to have coffee for you when you leave here, so you can pick up coffee and cookies on your way into your discussion group. And she promises that you'll be through by 11 for you night owls who want to are too stimulated and want to keep talking. Some of us couldn't go to sleep for hours last week. Then on the Friday group is closed. And on Monday nights, there are sign-up sheets again. Some of you couldn't find them last week. I have to work on my description, I guess, of where that is. When you walk out of here during the break, if you would go like you were going to leave the building and get sort of by the doors and turn around, facing this way, there would be a wall that was wooden, sort of wooden slats, and that's where the sign-up sheets are. And you need to sign up there. The first 20 who sign up will be meeting here in the room I just described, which is officially called 202A, and it will be meeting from 7 to 8:30 p.m. There will be another group that will be meeting in the Montlake area, and another group that will be meeting in a location that isn't determined. It sort of depends on how many of you sign up for those. That's not obligatory. This is just in response to questions that we've been asked by you. There's a car in the parking garage. Wait, unions are so observant, certain types. And I'll leave it to you to tell me what types after you've heard about types. The number is either IXL or IYL447. If that's your car, that's your problem. Better now than later. Well, we seem to have one of those every night, so that's pretty regular. Okay, books. I told you books are there, Mary. Monday nights. Same time. You'll be called with the address. So if that's more convenient, just after your name, put that you want that. You're welcome. You don't have to move out. You really could leave everything. Okay. That which does bring up the other issue. I've had several phone calls. It's just amazing to me. They tell me when you go public, you know, you get a lot of phone calls, and they're right. I got some phone calls from people who didn't like people leaving early last week. And I have set my watch for 9:23 p.m., and when it goes off, the ferry riders are going to get up and walk out the front, and that's because there's some high heels in that group, and they don't want to go out the stairs. But we really do ask. There were a lot of people here who really were irritated by other people leaving as they were trying to listen to a discussion. So we ask that you stay until 9:30 or that you go out the back door so that it's less of a problem for other people. The other thing I would say about you is that many of you are voluminous writers on the surveys. That was really fun. It was really fun. The kind words were real nice, and I thank you for those from a lot of you. And it was really heartwarming, a lot of the comments that you added, to really let us know why you're taking this and where you are in your own development and why this series for a lot of you is an exciting time. And I assume that by now you've noticed that it's exciting for some of us, too. It's my pleasure to introduce Emmett Early to you. Emmett received his PhD in psychology in 1977 from Washington State University. There really is a school over there. And if you're going to give me a bad time, Emmett, I'm going to give your school a bad time. He's been involved in Jungian psychology since 1965. And he's lectured before the Jung Society. He's done a seminar for the Jung Society. He's contributed articles to the San Francisco Jung Institute Library Journal. He's also lectured to the Washington Psychological Association and many other groups. currently has a private clinical practice, and he consults with veterans organizations. For those of you who are astrologically oriented, Emmett was born with Sun intercept in Leo and Mars rising in Capricorn, whatever that means. You could tell me later. He is an amateur woodworker and is a devotee of the Raven, and he's a darn nice person and a very scholarly person, and he really represents our field well. Please welcome Emmett.
Thank you, Marla. I want to thank Marla especially for the opportunity to do this lecture tonight on complexes. It's a very exciting topic to work on. I also want to express my appreciation to William Williford, who's Seattle's senior analyst, for many hours of discussion on this topic. Also, my colleagues Bill Bunzelmeyer and Tom Weir for their help in preparing this paper. And thanks for my wife, Ann Early, for discussing this paper with me for many hours. This talk tonight is going to take about an hour. And then we'll break and take a 10-minute break and then have lots of time for discussion tonight. For those of you who are too shy to ask questions in a group like this, if you want to write questions down on a piece of paper and hand them in at halftime, I'll try to get to them, and if I can't, I'll pass them on to the next presenter, and before the end of this series, we'll have addressed your question. So I encourage you to ask questions one way or the other. The title of this lecture tonight was Complexes, which Jung referred to as those imps of the mind. That title, by the way, was given to me by Marla. And at first I was put back by it, but I recalled a dream I had had recently, which is very apropos to the title. I was working with a very much decorated war hero, and working with this man in a group, and he did something somewhat irresponsible to another member of our group. And when I learned of his misbehavior, I tried to resolve this inconsistency in my mind. He had spent his career saving lives and then had mistreated this man. That night, I dreamt that I followed him through an aircraft hangar surrounded by other flyers. He was a retiring hero. But on his shoulder was a little man about a foot tall, also in a flight suit. He was standing on the hero's shoulder and looking back at me. Was this the imp of fame described by Shakespeare, or was this the child of the devil? Both could be imps. As a Jungian psychologist, I have a theory that gives me some insight into this man's problem, theory of complexes. I will come back to this story at the end of the lecture. What I'm going to present to you this evening is Jung's theory of complexes as I understand it. The first section I will give you as clear a picture as I can of what Jung meant by the term complex. I would describe the theoretical function of the complexes in the psyche. In the next section, I will give you examples from clinical practice of how two complexes interact, namely the father complex and the trauma complex. In section 3, I will look into the problem of integrating complexes. Jung developed a theory of complexes early in his career before he met Freud. The theory developed out of his experimental research with word associations. The essays I'm going to be referring to tonight flow from this period of his career, roughly 1903 to 1935. The word complex comes from the Latin verb complector, meaning to entwine, envelop, embrace, to take possession of. The Latin noun complexus means mutual entwinement. According to Jung, a feeling tone complex is a is an image of a certain psychic situation which is strongly accentuated emotionally and is, moreover, incompatible with the habitual attitude of consciousness. Jung is here referring to an ego-alien complex. This image has a powerful inner coherence and has its own wholeness and, in addition, a relatively high degree of autonomy, so that it is subject to the control of the conscious mind only to a limited extent, and therefore behaves like an animated foreign body in the sphere of consciousness. Jung explains in an earlier essay that the feeling tone complex is an affective state accompanied by somatic innervations. The ego is a psychological expression of the firmly associated combination of all body sensations. One's own personality is, therefore, the firmest and strongest complex. Jung states further that every affective event becomes a complex. If it encounters an already existing complex, it reinforces it. He notes that a complex would not be a complex at all if it did not possess a certain, even a considerable, affective intensity. Complexes, Jung said in a lecture simply, are due to passion. Others before Jung had used the term complex. What makes Jung's theory truly unique, however, is his hypothesis that a complex consists of a nuclear element and a large number of secondarily constellated associations. The nuclear element consists of two components. First, a factor determined by experience and causally related to the environment. Second, a factor innate in the individual's character and determined by his disposition. Complexes are thus a product of emotional experiences. That is, they are the images of those situations which are constellated by emotions. I imagine this happening physically, like a pool break in reverse, with the pool balls coming together as images attracted into a cluster by an emotion. An image that Jung gave us is that of a crystal developing about an axis. The axis itself is substanceless. In Jungian terms, the presence of emotion suggests archetypal involvement in the formation of the complex. That is, the event connects with an already existing event in the brain, either an archetypal potential or a previously formed complex, and that connection causes emotion. The complex itself takes up no space and ceases to exist except when constellated. We only know complexes exist at all by the effects of their action. Jung developed his theory as a result of his early experimental research with word association tests, primarily by measuring some 18 complex indicators in response to stimulus words, indicators such as delayed response, perseveration, and increased respiration. It is a totality of these complexes that forms the psyche, like the stuffing in a pillow. Yet, because complexes fluctuate from constellated to dispersed to a dispersed state, the psyche is never a fixed entity capable of being wholly described. According to Jung's definition, there are two factors that contribute to the strength of a complex: the strength of the affect and the redundancy of the experience. From this, we can easily imagine the powerful complexes which are commonly found: the mother complex, the father complexes, complexes from traumatic, sexual, and religious experiences, as well as often repeated experiences, especially those begun in a strong affective state, such as initial chemical intoxication and orgasm. Some complexes remain partially or fully conscious and, in fact, may be systematically developed as persona. My psychology complex began some 20 years ago when I first read Jung. And if I were to run off to Trinidad tomorrow and deny I was ever a psychologist, I would be haunted by a strong complex. Some complexes become unconscious through repression and strangeness. I spent a year in the Arctic in the Air Force in 1961, and I remember almost nothing of the experience except that it was otherworldly. Relationships can form complexes which, when suddenly suspended, leave one with a complex and a lingering sense of incompleteness until the complex is integrated or until it recedes from lack of tension into unconsciousness. Whether or not a complex operates pathologically depends on its relation to consciousness. If it is assimilated and accepted by the ego, the complex contributes its energy to one's identity. If it operates outside the ego's boundary, it becomes an alien experience. When a complex constellates outside consciousness, it can behave like a partial personality, thinking unclearly and superficially and often projected. Such complexes can provoke crimes for which the ego is punished. I frequently hear in court the defendant promising never to do anything that stupid again. He doesn't even remember the crime. And the criminal is not necessarily lying. It is the ego talking. Complexes animate our dreams and give us our neurotic symptoms. An example of a complex in a dream is told to me by a very meek man of Japanese ancestry. He dreamt of being confronted by a large bear on a mountain trail. The bear was being held on a leash by a North Vietnamese officer. As a draftee in Vietnam, this man had been wounded in a firefight with the North Vietnamese Army. The bear on the trail, I'm sure, represented his anger, which was blocked from his consciousness. Why would the anger be represented by a bear? Well, a bear is often a mother symbol, and for this man, that was relevant. In summary, then, it is a dissociation of the psyche and not the existence of highly charged affect per se that causes the problems we have with complexes. Rather than naming commonly found complexes, which has the effect of obscuring as much as it illuminates, it is preferable to classify complexes according to whether they have ever been conscious and subsequently have become unconscious. Jung referred to these as soul complexes, or images which have never been conscious, originating from the collective unconscious. Jung referred to these as spirit complexes. Regarding this distinction, Jung writes, "The soul complexes seem to belong to the ego, and the loss of them appears pathological." The opposite is true of spirit complexes. Their association with the ego causes illness, and their dissociation from it brings recovery. Of the spirit complexes, Jung writes, "So far as I can judge, these experiences, that is, intruding spirits, occur either when something so devastating happens to the individual that the whole previous attitude to life breaks down, or when for some reason the contents of the collective unconscious accumulate so much energy that they start influencing the conscious mind." An example of this was reported to me recently by a 55-year-old man who as a child was blown off a ship in an explosion. He told me that he was burned over a large part of his body and unconscious for months from concussion. When he regained consciousness, his first perception was of a Christ-like figure dressed in white robes with a gold halo who pointed to him and told him he would recover. I interpret the figure as a projection of the self, which Jung described as complexio oppositorum, the tension of life. An example of a soul complex in this same man was a repetitive nightmare he had of a black figure with flame-red arms and eyes who stood over him and threatened him. This I took to be an abstract visual impression of his or someone's dire condition following the explosion. To address more specifically the behavior of complexes, I will describe two complexes interacting, the father complex and the trauma complex. I find it useful to focus on the trauma complex because of the intensity with which it manifests and the clarity of its imagery, providing, of course, that we understand the traumatic situation from which it is formed. Talking about the interaction with parental complexes brings us to an observation of what C.A. Meyer refers to as family complexes, which may be passed on for generations. To introduce this topic, I will quote Jung from his essay, Mind and Earth. Anything that falls into the unconscious takes on a more or less archaic form. If, for example, the mother represses a painful and terrifying complex, she will feel it as an evil spirit pursuing her, a skeleton in the cupboard. This formulation shows that the complex has already acquired archetypal force. It sits on her like an incubus. She is tormented by nightmares. Whether she tells nightmare stories to the child or not, she nonetheless infects the child and awakens in its mind archetypal terror images from her own psychology. Both parents are capable of doing this, of course. Jung has occasionally referred to the phenomenon of the child of children living out the unconscious lives of their parents. For the child, this is not necessarily negative. The compulsion to create, for example, could be indicative of a complex passed on by a parent. As part of my practice, I work with war veterans, many of whom have fathers and grandfathers who are war veterans. In Vietnam, some 60% of those in combat had combat veteran fathers. Wars seem to afflict succeeding generations. To understand how the effects of war might be passed on as complexes, it is helpful to briefly examine trauma disorder. I would like to list the diagnostic criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder introduced in 1981. This is a standard used by virtually all the U.S. mental health community. The symptoms you will note describe either the behavior of the trauma complex or the depleted affect ego, that is, the ego left after trauma. Those symptoms involving the behavior of the trauma complex are recurrent and intrusive recollections of the event, recurrent dreams of the event, sudden acting or feeling as if the traumatic event were reoccurring because of an association with an environmental or ideational stimulus, hyper-alertness or exaggerated startle response, sleep disturbance, memory impairment or trouble concentrating, avoidance of activities that arouse recollection of the traumatic event, intensification of symptoms by exposure to events that symbolize or resemble the traumatic event. Depletion of the ego is indicated by symptoms such as numbing of responsiveness to or reduced involvement in the external world, markedly diminished interest in one or more significant activities, feeling of detachment or estrangement from others, constricted affect, and guilt about surviving when others have not, or about behavior required for survival. The emotional withdrawal of a parent and all of its manifestations influences a child. Guilt, often perceived as unfinished grief or the need to properly complete a traumatic event, and anger, influence a child to try to make life better for the parent or compels the child to distrust the parent. This was discussed by the second generation of death camp survivors extensively. The child of the trauma survivor then is vulnerable to unconsciously take up the quest, not knowing clearly how this relates to the parent. I recall Sir Gawain's cry as he comes forward to take up Arthur's battle with the fearsome Green Knight. "Before all, King, confide this fight to me. May it be mine." Here then are three cases of sons whose wartime traumas interact with their father complexes. Case A is for Art. Art was raised by a domineering father who was himself a Navy veteran of World War II Pacific combat. He described his father as perfectionistic and intimidating. His father, he said, forced him to join the Air Force. His job as an aircraft cargo handler took him to Vietnam, where he had a number of traumatic experiences involving the deaths of others. Ironically, he said his father had decided on the Air Force for him because it was the safest branch of the service. In the most pertinent trauma episode, this man was assigned to temporary duty in Phnom Penh, then the capital of Cambodia, which was under siege by the Khmer Rouge. He was at the time an NCO in charge of a crew of four men under the command of a captain. They were all in civilian clothes because there was no official U.S. presence there. They were doing something they weren't supposed to talk about. His job was unloading munitions. The airfield was under rocket, mortar, and artillery fire, which was daily increasing in intensity. One night, the officer ordered him to take his crew out and unload a plane of explosives. Art protested that it was too dangerous to do so, but the officer insisted that he carry out the order. While he was unloading the plane, mortars began walking toward them. And as they ran for cover, one exploded nearby, killing all four of his crew who were in front of him. He was knocked unconscious after seeing the flash of the explosion. The critical interaction for these complexes occurred recently when this man was promoted in his business to a position of some authority. The job entailed moving to a windowless office that felt like a bunker. The word "felt" here is important. He was living in an eastern city near a rail yard, and the sounds that emanated from the yard at night resembled that of incoming rockets. He began experiencing anxiety attacks, nightmares, and periods of disturbed sleep, featuring night sweats and night terrors. He began abusing drugs and alcohol, which he had also used to cope with his terror in Vietnam. He finally stole a large sum of money from his employer during a chemically induced period of amnesia. He dutifully confessed his theft and was immediately fired. That got him out of his position of authority. Mr. B, who I will call Bruce, had an abusive alcoholic father. His father would batter and harass Bruce's mother and brother as well, but Bruce, being the oldest boy, got the brunt of the beatings. His father's violence was unpredictable and often not correlated with any offense. He recalls being awoken at night by his father beating him. Bruce joined the Marine Corps at age 17 with his mother's permission. This is a real common story, by the way. Prior to that, he had been living intermittently in the streets and hustling to survive. He served in a line company in Vietnam as a rifleman. This company suffered such heavy losses that he claims that after 4 months he was the only surviving member of his original company. Everyone else had been shipped out, wounded, or killed. Bruce had several associations of his Marine Corps experience with his father. He said that he was comfortable with the brutality of boot camp because it didn't seem to be any worse than living with his father. Walking point, which is lead man in a patrol, in combat, he said, was like coming home and trying to pick out signs that his father had been drinking. Point man is the one who has to keep alert for booby traps and signs of enemy movement. Being harassed by snipers, similarly, was a familiar feeling. He said that he developed a distinct impression that his commanders didn't care about him and used his company to draw fire and test enemy strength, even to the point of once abandoning his unit in the field instead of sending promised relief. He and the other survivors had to run while fighting, dragging their wounded and leaving their dead to be cremated in airstrikes. For Bruce, father and life-threatening trauma are permanently associated. He is, needless to say, intensely ambivalent about treatment. One of the ways he copes with this is by calling me brother. He disassociates himself from any trappings of authority whatsoever. His dress and demeanor are the shadow of conservative conformity. He looks and acts like a trickster, and in fact belonged for a time to a motorcycle club with a trickster name, Gypsy Jokers. For him, being vulnerable creates intolerable tension. He cannot sleep without a weapon nearby. Bruce is also very intelligent and draws beautifully. His chief problem is coming to terms with his father complex so that he can establish an inner authority. For him, it is a struggle with death. Case C is for Carl, when you know it. Carl had a combat veteran father with whom he was never close. His father was an introverted salesman and something of a drudge worker. He had a bad back from military service for which he received minimal compensation. When he was home, his father tended to keep to himself. Like most World War II and Korean War veterans, he almost never talked about his combat experiences. Carl could not recall having any periods of intimacy with his father. His father watched sports on television, but never attended any of Carl's sporting events in high school. Carl felt a compulsion not only to join the Army as soon as he could after high school, but to repeatedly volunteer for elite fighting units. He went to Vietnam as an airborne ranger, and after 3 months volunteered for long-range reconnaissance, meaning that he went deep into enemy territory with small teams. He had several terrifying encounters with trauma on these patrols, and some of the worst of these were under security requirements in which he was sworn to secrecy. By the way, this is not at all unlike the molesting adult who swears the child to secrecy, which is a damn good way of ensuring trauma disorder. Carl received several decorations for valor, but his father died a week before his return to the U.S., and he was comatose when Carl visited him in the hospital. So Carl never was able to get his father's recognition. Carl's chief trauma problem is guilt, primarily connected with what he thinks were errors in judgment that led to the deaths of friends. He copes with the guilt by avoiding father-related activities. He works below his potential. He especially avoids making any commitments and avoids any situation in which someone might be dependent upon him. He's very angry at the government. I am inclined to think that he went to Vietnam to work through his father's guilt and found instead that he compounded it. Trauma, here defined as a death-related experience in which a person is overwhelmed and helpless to control the outcome, becomes a big complex by Jung's definition. The stronger the affect, the bigger the complex. It appears to be an aspect of complex activity that complexes may be constellated simultaneously. Thus, one complex, such as in this case the negative father complex, can be strengthened as an ego alien force by becoming associated with war-related trauma. Getting in touch with the father issues brings up the trauma. Getting in touch with trauma brings up the father issues. Treatment for these three men cannot be completely successful without a thorough confrontation with both complexes. Traumas of adult onset give us a model to understand the behavior of complexes. We see in the experiences of these three war veterans the image of the father enveloping images of government, military, and authority in general. Feelings of dependency, fear, rage, horror, and grief hold these images together. An archetypal aspect of the father is awakened as well, the Saturnine image of death. Also associated with these grave images and powerful feelings are incidental associations that are unique to each individual's trauma event, any of which are capable of constellating the whole trauma complex. Anniversary dates, odors, songs, for these guys, songs of the 60s. Faces, sounds, movements. Picture of Jane Fonda sitting on an anti-aircraft gun near Hanoi became for the Vietnam veterans the Morgan Le Fay, the negative anima compared to Betty Grable's saucy World War II Guinevere. Drugs used initially as welcome relief from trauma emotions became ways of maintaining emotional distance from, yet intimacy with, the trauma complex. For some, military paraphernalia became fetish objects which betoken relationship to the trauma event, like tributes to a hidden god. Mention of drugs, fetishes, and Morgan Le Fay introduces the final issue for this evening, the problem of integrating the soul complex. That's really what I want to focus on. Remember that the complex operates unconsciously because it is incompatible with the ego. Jung writes, "A complex can be really overcome only if it is lived out to the full." In other words, if we are to develop further, we have to draw to us and drink down to the very dregs what, because of our complexes, we have held at a distance. Drinking down to the very dregs sounds Dionysian, doesn't it? Things Dionysian tend not to be very compatible with our culture. Remember that Dionysian trees were hung with corpses of sacrificial victims at this time of the year, and not tinsel and angels. Jung writes also that certainly one of the commonest causes of unconscious complexes is a moral conflict, which ultimately derives from the apparent impossibility of affirming the whole of one's nature. Elsewhere, he writes that certain complexes arise on account of painful and distressing experiences in a person's life, experiences of an emotional nature which leave lasting psychic wounds behind them. A bad experience of this sort often crushes valuable qualities in an individual. So the question arises, how does one confront and drink to the dregs that which was repressed because of moral conflict or because of painful and distressing experiences? Of course, the answer is that one integrates such a complex with moral conflict and pain. Jung is very explicit in his essay on the therapeutic value of abreaction, volume 16 of his collected works. He says that one can best integrate the complex in relationship with the doctor. He writes, "The essential factor of the unconscious complex is the dissociation of the psyche and not the existence of highly charged affect. And consequently, the main therapeutic problem is not abreaction, but how to integrate the dissociation." It's not enough just to uncover the complex and say, "Oh, there it is." One has to integrate it, and that takes time. The conflict becomes then... I know a woman who is very one-sided. She's a business executive in a large downtown bank. Her husband is also an executive. They make a lot of money. She dresses in the latest fashion, and they live in a wonderful house that has a vast view of Puget Sound. She also shoplifts compulsively. She doesn't go out to shoplift. The urge comes upon her. She becomes possessed by a partial personality that seems to be like a street person, tough and calculating. To meet her, however, one is impressed with her diplomacy and sweetness. It is important to know that she was raised by what she thought was a very mean mother and an alcoholic father who was convicted of business fraud. She idolizes her father and hates her mother, who she says was bitterly jealous of her relationship with her father. I suspect that this woman has a negative mother complex and is having a symbolic, incestuous affair of sorts with her father. Her task is to integrate this tough street person and make that partial personality a facet of her whole personality. To do so, she may become less sweet, but more real. But this will be painful for her. For one thing, she must make her father more real in order to do this. To set off this woman's problem with perhaps a more vivid example, recalling the imp of our title tonight, I would like to close by reading to you from a recent article in the PI. Maybe you remember it. A woman who was kept as a sex slave for 7.5 years prays the sentence of 104 years imposed on her captor, saying that she was just glad he won't be able to hurt me or anyone else again. The woman who was kidnapped at knife point by Cameron Hooker while hitchhiking near Red Bluff, California in 1977, said she has no feelings for the man who imprisoned her and forced her to participate in bizarre sex acts. This woman now has an imp in her psyche consisting of images and emotions formed during 7.5 years of captivity. Her consciousness has expanded. Jung said once that as consciousness expands, it also darkens. Isn't that a beautiful statement? As consciousness expands, it also darkens. If she is able to fit this trauma complex into her life and accept it by adopting an appropriate attitude, she will ultimately gain energy from the experience. If, as is far more likely, she repressed the experience, either by forgetting or by dissociating herself emotionally, then she will lose energy and develop neurotic symptoms. Seems like that's already happened if she has no feelings for the man. The energy of the complex with its images and emotions will pass from conscious to unconscious, and what ego she has left will be brittle. Jung referred to the traumatized ego as an affect ego, which is a descriptive term that illustrates the susceptibility of the survivor to overreactive affect. We are all aware at some level when we lose energy to the unconscious and we mourn that loss. To return to the opening dream, my own dream, I left those flyers in that tunnel going into the hangar, and I began going up flights of stairs into rooms, not knowing where I was going or what I was looking for, but confident that I would know what to do when I got there. This was, for me, a dream of the hero's quest. It is the heroic quest to discover and assimilate unconscious complexes. This was a dream of a complex constellated by my exposure to a real-life hero and his dark side. The hero's quest is universal, but only in the abstract. It is for each individual a unique and lonely experience. If there's any help at all, be grateful. You are blessed. If anyone offers to make it easy for you, be wary, because you're being tricked. Thank you.
Other questions? Questions of Emmett? No questions. You understood everything he said.
Question is commenting on Jung's statement that complexes can be really only be integrated if they are lived out to the full, and that's really the crux of analysis or any most forms of psychological treatment that are analytically oriented. This is a terribly difficult problem when you're dealing with complexes that occur as a result of violent trauma. Living them out to the full can be pretty scary. One of the ways we do this with the combat veterans is by encouraging them to discuss the traumatic experiences sometimes over and over and over and over again. In the context of what we call the RAP groups, which is a group of 6 or 8 or 10 other combat veterans who had similar experiences, this feeds them images, and they feed each other these images of their traumatic experiences, and they relive them. When they go home in their dreams and other emotional experiences, we do it very slowly. I don't recommend in these kinds of context, these kinds of traumas, reliving them necessarily in psychodrama. That could be pretty risky. I don't like to force things out. I like to uncover layer after layer through discussion. Discussions get emotional enough without being melodramatic about it. I think one can live a complex out to the full in various symbolic ways that don't necessarily have to do with acting them out. This is a terrible mistake sometimes when someone gets in touch with a sexual complex, for instance, that has to do with children, and they act it out. There are lots of ways one can get in touch with a complex like that without acting out in the street. They're writing, drawing, discussing, various ways of channeling that energy and getting to know it and accepting it as part of oneself without misbehaving in a socially unacceptable way. Jung was a strong advocate of drawing, performing in dance, performing with other kinds of media, certainly with writing, story writing, for instance, is a wonderful way of getting to know one's complex. Drinking down to the dregs just means getting close and familiar with what one has previously kept alienated. Sir? Would I distinguish between the soul and the spirit complexes and the therapeutic strategy for dealing with each one? I think that's an extremely important question. One of the reasons I dealt lightly with spirit complexes is that the future lectures are going to be dealing much more with archetypes and phenomena of the collective unconscious, and I thought I would use that as an excuse not to get into it very much. Soul complexes are much more interesting to me because they're the stuff the therapeutic work that we all have to do, whether we're in analysis or not. They're simply experiences that we have in our lifetime that are unpleasant, or alienating, or culturally unacceptable, or just downright strange, and one of the kind experiences. Some of these are difficult enough to uncover and integrate, and some are relatively innocuous, like my year in Thule, Greenland was relatively innocuous and absent of trauma, but it was so strange that I really have no bridges to connect with it anymore. Spirit complexes are alien to our consciousness. They're the kinds of things that make you crazy, and you don't necessarily want them around. When we had the discussion, I used the example of Jim Jones as being possessed by or Adolf Hitler, you know, being possessed by spirit complexes that were so captivating they in turn captivated others and constellated that same complexes in others. Those are spirit complexes as far as I'm concerned. Treating schizophrenics is different than treating non-schizophrenics. Treating anyone who has a psychosis, one treats them gently and one tries to contain those kinds of what Jung called. I don't especially like that term spirit complex. That's just one that he used. One tries to contain it, to make sense out of it, or at least help the schizophrenic put it in a place where they're not paying a lot of attention to it. Put it out of consciousness if possible. That makes the schizophrenic whole. Soul complexes, yes. He wants to know what the term abreaction is. That, for me, is the emotional uncovering in various forms. Abreaction is for me, the discovery of emotional content that has a lot of emotional power. Fritz Perls was one who liked to do that. He liked to uncover. He liked people to abreact in therapy. Psychodrama, I think, brings out a lot of abreaction. Certainly, hypnosis does. It's the first stage of therapy. It's the uncovering, and the next stage for me, anyway, is integrating, and that's the longer stage. Does that make it more clear to you? Others may have a different definition of abreactions. And the black sweater up there. Boy, this is the crux of the moral problem, isn't it, in our society? It is the case that much of what we are exposed to in our society is also
unacceptable leftovers from previous stages collective lifetime or intrusions from other cultures, and they're just downright alien to us. When would the exposure to pornography be positive? I don't know necessarily that it would be positive. It is important for one to learn about one's own repressed material. And I think one of the attractions of pornography in our culture is that it signals a lot of sexual repression that goes on. And that's what makes it so powerfully attractive and hypnotic for some people. However, dealing with a complex doesn't necessarily mean dealing with that material. I wouldn't necessarily encourage a client to go out and read pornography, but I wouldn't necessarily discourage him either. I would try to talk around that topic. I know that sounds humorous, but it is disastrous for a therapist to come head on with a complex. It's a standoff. It usually means the client goes elsewhere. There are lots of ways to integrate a complex by looking elsewhere. That allows the complex to be brought out and discussed in an environment that is not damning. That's how it got repressed in the first place.
Sorry.
Oh, is that right? I was waving my arms too much.
No, you're all set.
Is that a helpful expression? Lady in the sweater. Let me try. I don't know if I can summarize that question. In dealing with the soul, with the spirit complexes, the problem in treatment is to help a person who is having psychotic episodes to take an appropriate perspective to the material that is not identifying with it. The quest when dealing with a soul complex, that is something that was conscious and then repressed, is to identify with it and put it in its proper place. Form an appropriate attitude toward this material. The spirit complex, one doesn't want to identify with it. That is inflationary, to identify with such material. That makes you crazy. That's what the manic person in a manic psychotic episode is doing, identifying with highly inflating material. It's in working with a schizophrenic, it's there and it's churning up in the person if he's not medicated, If I were working with a person like that, I would want the person to be able to know it's there. They can't deny it's there, but to be able to not identify with it, to keep that ego, such as it is, focused on the mundane, the concrete, you know, the sort of things like where are you going to live and what are you going to eat tonight, and who your neighbors are, rather than the nature of God and the devil and so on. Because they really get into it. In the black sweater there. Yes. I guess it's black. Does all mental pathology manifest as complexes? From Jung's definition, that is the stuff of the psyche, complexes. So the answer would be yes. Right behind the gentleman. Yeah. Now, wants me to talk more about the woman who had the shoplifting complex. That seemed to me clearly to be material that had to do with her own development that she could not acknowledge. She was a tough cookie, and because of the way she developed her persona, she just didn't have that in her conscious repertoire. She was a Vogue model, sort of, that didn't deal with the meanness and toughness that her parents left her with. Well, one doesn't want to go head on and say, don't do it anymore. be the cop or the father and say you have to take the stuff back, or become the punishing parent. There's usually lots to talk about, and when the client, my client, is ready, then she tackles it, because it's an intrusive problem in her life and going to get her in bad trouble one of these days. But there are other things in layers above that she had to deal with, and she wanted to deal with, and her parents were such that I damn well better not tell her what to do. So she dealt with that at her own pace, and when she did finally get around to dealing with the shoplifting, it was with much gusto. But there was lots of other things to talk about first. This lady. Certain complexes lead to mania, certain complexes lead to depression, certain complexes lead to schizophrenia, she wants to know. That's a terribly complex question. complexes can form when bad things happen to us, or things unacceptable happen, or like I say, if I go off to Trinidad tomorrow, I would become depressed because I would have lost a big chunk of energy that I'm showing you right now. Loss of ego strength, loss of conscious energy can result in depression. Complexes, according to Jung, that come strictly from the collective unconscious, form various kinds of psychotic symptoms. Now, this gentleman that had the devastating childhood trauma, was blown off a ship and burned badly and unconscious for a long time. He probably gets diagnosed schizophrenic a lot. He would have if he ever got close to a mental health person. But that wouldn't necessarily be a good true diagnosis because of his trauma. He is a very strange man. Very strange man. He had devastating wartime trauma. This was a ship trying to get away from London during the Nazi wolf pack days, and they torpedoed the ship he was on. He was so crushed by that experience that he had very little left to build on, and his life has been very idiosyncratic since, very kind of rough hewn. So he's been a little strange, but hears voices, but he couldn't necessarily be called schizophrenic. In my true definition, although a lot of people might diagnose him that, there The diagnostic manual that I referred to in my address has a couple of categories that are sort of like schizophrenia, but not schizophrenic kind of personality disorders. This gentleman. Is one way of talking around this, referring to this, the shoplifter, requiring the client to read legends about legends and myths. That's perhaps a way to do it. I don't take that active a position with clients and tell them, or even suggest to them what to read. Well, once in a while I do, but not very often. I would much rather work with what she wants to work with. And then if the images arise from her, then we can, you know, I may comment on how that relates to such and such. And if she's a mind, she may want to read more about it. But in this case, and with some other clients who have bad parents, you don't want to tell them what to do. They balk at that, or they scoff. This woman would call me sophomoric if I told her to read a myth. The gentleman in the maroon, what other methods are good for integrating complexes besides a doctor? I assume that Jung was writing in the context of Switzerland in the 20s or 30s at the time. I think what he is referring to is the need for someone who is getting into troubled waters in uncovering unconscious complexes to have someone who knows what they're doing to depend on, to rely on, and to help contain that problem so they don't come to pieces. Remember that this stuff has affect in it. That is, it's highly charged emotionally. And, well, for my vets, for instance, it can make them feel crazy. When they get into images of bodies being blown apart, that's crazy-making, particularly if it comes upon them involuntarily. The only time that they really will risk doing that is after spending time knowing that this person knows that A knows what he's doing and is not going to go away when these images start popping out. That is, they can get shaky and the doctor won't. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a doctor. The vets I work with don't give a damn about your credentials so long as you know what you're doing. And it may take a long time for them to be convinced of that. Would I speak briefly about groups and what I do in groups and how they differ from individual work? I never for the life of me thought that I would ever work in group context after graduate school. And I found myself doing it. And I feel that being a Jungian, having a Jungian orientation has helped a lot in writing the Vietnam phenomena through. It happens to be necessary, and I would strongly advocate it in working with people who have like kinds of trauma in their lives. There's an awful lot of common experiences to share, and there's that collective sense of universality of symptoms that is tremendously helpful in restoring a sense of being normal, being okay. When I work in a group, I consider the group experience to be a natural phenomena, and I have a few rules about groups, but very few, and that is really what I want them to do is get in there and talk together and to grow intimate with each other. And in that intimacy, and trust allow themselves to uncover this emotional material. And as the group grows, feed more, as people fall away, feed more people in. I allow the veterans to go on until they're done. And sometimes this takes years. And the funding people don't like that. The Veterans Administration, who I don't work for, but fund some of my work, want to limit things. There's a kind of a McDonald's attitude about mental health in this country that wants things to be quick and simple, and somehow it should be done with in 20 or 30 visits. And it just simply doesn't work that way. But the groups have to be natural. For the vets, it has to be natural. It has to be something that's real. And that means you have to be able to allow a lot of raging and profanity and, calling Jane Fonda all kinds of names to get them feeling genuine, that they're in a part of the real world. And it's not something I'm trying to make them do. But far enough into the group, they'll project onto me the idea that I'm trying to make them act normal. But that's okay, we'll work with that. What do you do with someone with a strong ego who can go on for a long time before they get into the real conflict? Lord, that's a big problem. I find very smart people to be very difficult clients to work with. The more successful they are and the more they have to lose by changing their style, the harder it is to work with them. They have, it's the old joke about how many psychologists take to change a light bulb. You know, only takes one, but the light bulb really has to want a screw. It's true though. A person who is very successful and wants to go on being successful is not going to want to change very much. It's often crisis that brings a person into therapy. It's death in the family or divorce or something terrible happens. Something shakes their cage and they come into therapy. And in a few weeks, this very strong ego person is put together again and will leave therapy unless somehow they get hooked into wanting to grow. Sometimes midlife, of course, is the big change. One more. The TA theory that you flip into an anti-script. Yeah. I think Jung dealt with that problem often in the sense of, what do you call it, enantiodromia, something turning into its opposite. And you see it sometimes in conversion phenomena. Saul changes to Paul by a flash of light on the road. That's a problem with one-sidedness, isn't it, I think? I don't know what more to say about it. I'm not too familiar with transactional analysis to talk about anti-scripts. Do I find it's helpful to work with someone who has worked, for a client to work with someone who has already worked through the same complex? Jung made a statement, I think, and others have made it too, that you really can't take someone any further than you've been yourself in treatment. I think that's certainly true. On the other hand, you don't have to die to do grief work, and you don't have to have cancer to to help someone with cancer. And I've never been to war. But it is true that the therapist has to be able to hold all that comes out of the client and not run away from it, as is the case often with trauma victims, rape victims, and the tendency when one deals with trauma, professionals have a terrible time with this, by and large, because they tend to pretend it's not there after a while. The client and the therapist kind of conspire to deny that the trauma is really the problem. So that even though a patient may come in with a rape story to therapy, the therapist finds themselves dealing with other things and kind of glibly not looking at the rape situation. This has been true with veterans up until recently. Vietnam veterans would go into therapy for depression or anger management, and Vietnam would never get talked about, even at the VA. This is kind of changing now, so that it's sort of a flag for a lot of therapists now when someone says they've been to war. But you'll see a therapist do a good history on a person, and he'll say, "Well, then I went to Vietnam, and then I came back from Vietnam," and the therapist goes on with the history. But there's no mention of what happened there. And it's sort of mutually ignored. We're out of time. Any more questions? The next presenter can field them, I'm sure.